Live from KCUR News, this is KC Currents on Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, we visit a neighborhood in Kansas City, Kansas, that until recently was considered on the decline.
We had issues with drive-bys, car chases, that kind of thing. But I think the important thing is people like us didn't move.
St. Peter Waterway is one of six neighborhoods targeted for improvement by Greater Kansas City LISC. And now the community is considered sustainable. We'll talk about what that means. We're taking your calls about urban redevelopment. Plus, a committee is looking at changing the way Kansas City, Missouri is governed. Do we finally need a strong mayor? And stop by a cheerleading gym for African American girls.
Let's go again. This you can't be afraid to do.
It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Good morning and welcome to Casey Currents. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region, and now we're live so we can take your calls on some of the big issues in our community. Speaking of which, Kansas City is known as a weak mayor town. Now that's no slight on Mayor Sly James. It's just the way the city charter sets up our government, where the mayor is basically a glorified city council member, and the city manager really runs the town. Since June, a group of citizens have been meeting to make recommendations to revise the charter. And two of the major issues they've been looking at are the role of the mayor and the composition of the city council. One close observer and participant in the process is Jared Carr. He teaches public administration at UMKC and is the director of the Cookingham Institute of Urban Affairs. Professor Carr, thanks for joining us on KC Currents.
Thank you very much.
Now, you just moved here from Detroit 2 years ago. So just informally, have you gotten a sense of how content or discontent locals here in Kansas City are with their city government?
I actually think they seem to be fairly content, certainly, again, as compared to Detroit, which there was an awful lot of conflict in the city, unhappiness over services, et cetera. But so, yeah, I think compared to Detroit, Kansas City is doing very well.
And considering Detroit recently went bankrupt, I think there's pretty solid reasons for that.
Yes, yes.
So in looking at potential charter revisions, what do these terms weak mayor or strong mayor really mean?
Thank you. Wanted to back up a little bit. So we often hear the term council manager and mayor council thrown around. So there really are two very distinct systems, and they're based on the idea of a separation of power, where in the council manager system, you take away the division of a legislative and executive branch and move them into one.
Legislative executive is what we're kind of used to thinking of in the federal government.
Exactly.
Right?
And the mayor council structure is based essentially on the design of the federal government. So you collapse the two branches into one, which is designed to produce more consensual decision making. The executive responsibilities in the council manager system are assigned to the city manager and in the mayor council to the mayor. Another really key difference between the two is how the responsibilities for the a CAO is assigned. In the mayor council system, it's the mayor and the council manager. The council and the mayor together make these decisions.
And so this idea of a strong mayor is the mayor council system, right?
Yes. And when you hear a strong and weak mayor, you're usually talking about the mayor council system.
Yeah.
But what there really is, there's a lot of institutional variety. These two terms are kind of end extremes that in reality, very few cities actually have that. There's been a lot of move toward the middle where each side adopts a little bit of the other. And in Kansas City's case, I mean, I wouldn't describe Mayor James as a very, very weak mayor. I would say the council manager mayor tends to be weaker than the mayor council. But the mayor is directly elected, also has veto power, and has other types of power that makes the mayor stronger than you might classically think of in a council-manager system.
And is there something about this particular mayor and this particular council that might do well with this system or do poorly in this system?
Just from my short time here, I actually think he does very well in this system. I think it takes a different kind of mayor, right? Because in the mayor-council structure, you have coercive power. You have the ability to set your agenda and move forward with council involved, of course, but it's very different when you're part of the council, you share the responsibility of overseeing the manager with the council. And so it takes a mayor that is able to build coalitions, operate more consensually, facilitate. And this mayor actually does pretty well, but it's probably a little bit challenging for many mayors.
But some people think just because this mayor does well with it doesn't mean it's necessarily a good system for the city.
I would say, well, most of the really large cities in the country are mayor-council. You do have some large ones, such as Oklahoma City, Fort Worth, us, Cincinnati. There's quite a few that are large. But I would argue that in a city this large, with the people tend to want a single political leader to focus on as the mayor. So there's always this agitation to make the mayor stronger when you have a council manager structure.
And to be able to make the mayor accountable for mistakes that are made. I mean, here you can then look at the city manager as really having been in charge.
And that's our typical conception of accountability in this country, right? Again, based on when we think about the federal government, we think of accountability operates through elections and these elected officials are responsive to us. The council manager structure works more on bureaucratic accountability, hiring a professional manager who understands how to do things. And so it's a different kind of accountability structure.
What would change if we went to a system which was a mayor-council system or a strong mayor system?
It's hard to know, right, because there's so many moving parts, right? I mean, that's the beauty of social science. There's a lot of pieces to this. But I think you could predict more conflict. You could probably also predict the ability to move programs faster, right? You have this single policy leader that people tend to focus on more. You know, there's a really large difference between the kind of administrative experience that a city manager brings and a mayor. So you could also, I mean, that in let me say this, if this was a mayor council system, very likely you'd have somebody like Troy Schulte that was hired by the mayor. So you would also have some, you know, fairly good experience.
Somebody who was a professional administrator.
Yeah.
As opposed to a politician or somebody, as in Sly James' case, who had never been in politics before until he became mayor.
Right. And so they often talk about the difference between the two forms, political decision-making versus administrative decision-making.
Hmm. Now, what about the city council? Currently, we have six districts in Kansas City, Missouri, mm-hmm. and each has one council member that's elected just from that district, and then another who's in that district, who lives in that district, but mm-hmm. is elected citywide or at large. So is this a common setup?
It's not unusual to have these mixed systems. I'm not sure that I've seen any where it's equally balanced. But, you know, as you can guess, right, they often think of the at-large as providing a city perspective, the district or the ward is providing a neighborhood or at least a more local perspective, and so oftentimes you're trying to get a little bit of a balance. Kansas City has chosen to have equal. It's not unusual to see, say, 80% of them would be district and a smaller percent would be. And that's certainly, I would say, I've been watching the process. There's two really big issues they're focusing on. Strengthening the power of the mayor to some extent, and this idea of potentially changing the districts.
And that idea is in part coming from some Latino and African-American leaders who say that the council should have fewer or no at-large council members because it dilutes the power of Black or Latino neighborhoods to pick their own representatives. And that citywide, maybe not the same person would be picked as that community would choose. They say we would have more leaders of color. Wondered, what does your research show?
Again, there's a lot of different elements to it, but I think that's a reasonable proposition generally, is that if you have districts, you change the ability of people to win. You change kind of the viability of particular candidates. Maybe it's racial, or also maybe it's people with fewer resources. And so at the very minimum, you probably change who can win when you go to a district, more districts.
And there's been particular concern that there hasn't been a Latino city council member for a long time. Do you think that could make a difference there?
It could. New enough to the city that I don't know the demographics all that well, but I do have a sense from what I've seen so far is that the Latino population isn't quite as concentrated as African American. So you may have a little more ability to draw in a district if that's what you're trying to get.
And again, Kansas City changed district boundaries just 2 years ago. It's so complicated. But some are suggesting more smaller districts. What are the implications of that idea?
Well, so it depends. So if the more smaller district means more council members, right? So if you're maintaining the same council, at some level, it means, right, probably less resources necessary to win, which at least kind of changes the kind of people you get. But on the other hand, right, there's an argument, too, that says fewer districts means more people with a citywide perspective, more people with experience, And it's harder to win without some sort of name visibility and experience in government.
That's interesting. So when you run citywide, you basically need more money to run.
And it helps if people have heard of you.
Is there a sweet spot for the number of council members?
Actually, nine. Nine is actually, I did see one study once that said that's the perfect number.
Interesting. Well, Jared Carr is director of UMKC's Cookingham Institute of Urban Affairs. Thanks for breaking down the city charter review process for us.
You're very welcome.
What makes a neighborhood sustainable? In particular, what about a neighborhood that's struggling to fight crime and blight? In 2006, six urban communities were targeted for improvements by the Local Initiative Support Corporation of Greater Kansas City. LISC is a national group that works with local organizations and communities. For the first time in its 33-year history of working in Kansas City, LISC is announcing one of these neighborhoods has graduated. That means St. Peter Waterway can sustain its redevelopment on its own and is considered a community where people want to live, work, play, and raise families. We want to hear from you. Do you live in a community that's been targeted for urban redevelopment? And what does a sustainable community look like to you? We're taking your calls now at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, to get a feel for how St. Peter Waterway has changed, we sent Casey Current's Suzanne Hogan to check it out.
This is how every morning begins in St. Peter Waterway, an area, according to LISC, that covers 11th to 16th, Minnesota to Oroville in Kansas City, Kansas. They ring at 6, 12, and 6 every day from the tall bell tower of the Cathedral at Resurrection Catholic Church, which used to be called St. Peter's. Father Harry Schneider has been with the church for 4 years.
I think for a lot of the community, and even those who are not Catholic, it's a reassuring presence.
When I was a kid, that's how we knew to go home for dinner. 6 o'clock bells rang and you got home. So it's just, I wake up in the morning to the bells.
Patty Orth has lived in the neighborhood her whole life. She's raised her kids and grandkids here. She's been living in this 100-year-old home on 15th Street for 38 years. Orth saw her neighborhood change in the 80s and 90s as a lot of people started moving south to Johnson County or to the Piper area in western Wyandotte County.
We had prostitutes walking our streets. I mean, in our neighborhoods, walking the streets. And, you know, you don't want your kids to see that kind of stuff. There was some drug houses, and we had issues with drive-bys, car chases, that kind of thing. But I think the important thing is people like us didn't move. You know, we said, we're not going to move.
That's how Orth got involved with the Cathedral Neighborhood Association, which she's been the president of for the past 10 years. It covers all of what LISC identifies as St. Peter Waterway and more, from 10th to 22nd, central to Minnesota. An area home to the original Fritz's restaurant, which is a point of pride for residents. They deliver food to tables using a toy train that zips around a track above your head. In 2006, when LISC identified St. Peter Waterway as a target neighborhood, Patty Orth saw an opportunity to tackle some growing community problems. Crime, blight, problems with infrastructure. She and members of the community began meeting to draft a quality of life plan and common goals.
It was an eye-opener, and I've lived here my whole life, and I learned a lot of stuff about the community. So it's
like, what kind of stuff?
Well, like, there is a world outside the Catholic Church. That's one thing. And that, you know, people do care. It's just not a small group of people that care.
They engaged with their local police department to establish community policing. They worked on a plan with the Unified Government of Wyandotte County to go halfway with residents to finance new sidewalks. Community Housing of Wyandotte County, or CHWC, a community development corporation, worked closely with LISC and acquired unkept properties in the target area, and since have rehabbed or built over 70 homes and offer multiple first-time homeowner assistance grants. This started to attract more people. In 1990, the neighborhood was about a third Latino. Today, in St. Peter Waterway, the Latino population has doubled.
My kids have grown up and they are very well-rounded because they've grown up with all kinds of people.
One of the controversial changes has been the implementation in 2008 of a traffic calming plan. Streets changed to one-ways, they put in different stop signs. Patty Orth says a lot of neighbors still don't like this.
They have to drive maybe a block out of their way. People that live out of the area don't like it at all because they can't cut through. But, you know, you go to the new subdivisions, and that's how they build all of them. You can go in one way, but you got to come back out that way, too.
Crimes against people and property have decreased by almost 40% since 2009. Fewer drive-by shootings were reported in 2010 and 11. Now, kids fill the streets to play. People hang out on their porches, work in the yard. 17th Street, a long strip of old, well-kept homes, typically goes all out at neighborhood functions, throwing barbecues, Christmas lighting competitions. On Halloween, they can expect 3,000 kids. Patty Orth has already started buying Halloween candy. She gets the 17th Street runoff with an average of 300 to 500.
That's what's so fun about it. Our neighborhood is that people do still congregate and meet and have a good time.
Another popular congregation site is Waterway Park. Over 100 years old, it used to be a shallow lake. Then it became a small play area with a baseball field that became a hotbed for drug deals and prostitution in the 80s and 90s. But CHWC, with help from LISC and the city, as part of the plan, came in and cleaned it up. They took out the ball field, put in a playground, and just recently landscaped, adding trees and a walking path. At about 6:30 every night, the park fills up with people from the neighborhood. Since the improvements, the park sees an average of 80 to 100 visitors a day. Tracy Jordan and her six children live four blocks from the park. She's been happy with the transformation, but feels like even more could be done.
There's like another acre and a half that they can put something on.
Steve Curtis, the community organizer for CHWC, agrees. He says plans for a soccer field are in the works. He grew up in KCK and later in life decided to move back because he missed the diversity and style of people.
Real kind of blue-collar attitude, you know, just very straightforward, sometimes a little more blunt than you would like, but always speaking the truth.
Curtis's main job with the CHWC has been to engage youth in community activities.
All these garages in here were tagged all the time. So the kids came with a program 3 years ago to talk to the owners, paint a mural on the back of the garage, and CHWC would put in a solar-powered motion detection light.
The Art Squad has painted nearly 20 murals on garages and alleyways. They weeded and picked up trash.
We wanted to make them, like, not like a creepy part that, like, people were afraid to go to.
17-year-old Amber Finley is a senior at Sumner Academy. She and her 15-year-old sister are responsible for a lot of the paintings. Garages with a Monet-type landscape, a rose painted for Rosie, an elderly resident, a city skyline, outer space, a crazy cat raccoon painted on the back of Bill's garage, who's known in the area for feeding feral cats.
He has tons of cat food and cat toys all set out on his porch, and he leaves it there overnight and just lets all the neighborhood cats go there. If you have a cat, it has probably been on his porch.
Finley feels like it's bringing more people together. Kids cut through, outsiders go on mural tours.
People in that house always come out and give us water, and they don't speak any English, but it's like you can tell they're like admiring it, and their kids go over and look at it. It's nice.
Estaba muy bien pintado ahí los.
Cruz Morales lives in the house across the street from the community garden. He bought the house 3 years ago and is fixing it up. He says he likes this neighborhood. It's calm. The only problem is the muchachos, boys, who are responsible for occasional theft and vandalism. Amber Finley's ladder was stolen over the summer, keeping her from finishing higher up parts of some of the murals. And a few solar lights have been broken. Finley was on the bus when she noticed the most recent taggings that happened only a couple weeks ago on two of their murals. She got upset and texted Steve Curtis immediately.
And I texted him and I was like, can we get a community officer? Because I know who did it. So I'm like, can we get a community officer to go to this kid's house and force him to paint with us? Make him understand the hard work that goes into it so maybe he won't destroy other people's things next year.
The Art Squad plans to continue their efforts to enhance the neighborhood and will continue to paint over tags. Next week, LISC will name St. Peter Waterway as a sustainable community. As the neighborhood looks ahead to graduation, it's unclear how much support from outside organizations like LISC they'll need in the future to keep making progress. For Casey Currents, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
See photos of the Art Squad's garage murals in St. Peter Waterway on our website, kcur.org. We're going to take a quick break, but after that, we continue the conversation about what makes or breaks an urban neighborhood. How does it become sustainable? We want to hear your thoughts about where you live. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. You're listening to KC Currents. Welcome back to KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We just paid a visit to St. Peter Waterway, one of six communities targeted by Greater Kansas City LISC in 2006 as part of their Neighborhoods Now program. St. Peter Waterway will be graduating. LISC says it's a sustainable community now. How do you know when a community is sustainable? What does that look like to you? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. Here in studio to talk about building sustainable communities is city planner Daniel Serta. He is vice chair of the Wyandotte County Planning Commission. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
And Micah Kubik, who's senior program officer of Greater Kansas City LISC. That's the Local Initiative Support Corporation. Micah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Micah, what exactly does it mean that St. Peter Waterway is graduating?
Well, St. Peter Waterway is now a sustainable community, which means that they've achieved a lot of the priorities that the residents themselves set out for themselves back in 2006 when LISC began the Neighborhoods Now program. Everything that we do is in partnership with neighborhoods, is in partnership with residents and organizations, and we have them set goals for themselves. St. Peter Waterway has achieved those goals, and I think if you drive through St. Peter Waterway today versus in 2006, you would see the difference. It's one of those things where you sort of have to see it to believe it, to know it. But it's definitely true. There's a huge change in the housing stock, in the community safety, and just the vibrancy of the neighborhood.
What were those goals specifically? I mean, were they some of those things you just listed?
Sure. So there was a huge priority around community safety, around youth development, around making sure that there was a spirit of community that was strengthened in that neighborhood, and especially around the housing stock, too. It's an older neighborhood, and we wanted to make sure that there was quality, affordable housing there.
So does that mean that they don't need your support anymore?
Well, every neighborhood always has challenges, regardless of where it is, how old it is. Every neighborhood has challenges. So they still need support. They still need support from outside the community, but especially from within the neighborhood. I want to make it really clear that everything that's happened in St. Peter Waterway is because there were a lot of really engaged, really passionate, really great people who were living there and made it possible. So it's not one of those things where LISC is the one that did it. It's really about the neighbors themselves who were passionate enough to do something. And they're going to continue to be engaged because they live there. They have a stake in the future. And that's the way that St. Peter Waterway is going to continue to be sustainable, by the residents themselves making sure that that happens.
But some residents may feel that if there's less support, that their progress might be reversed, that it was that support that maybe pushed them over the edge and enabled them to get to this certain point. But how do you know it's actually sustainable on their own without your support?
Sure. So a lot of what we have done and what CHWC has done and what the residents have done is make sure that they've built capacity inside the neighborhood. So CHWC is a very strong, very, very strong and very, very capable community development corporation that's going to continue to work there regardless.
That's community housing.
Community housing of Wyandotte County. That's right. They're going to continue to be there regardless. And we've worked with them to build their capacity over the years to make sure that they're going to be able to keep on keeping on regardless.
But there must be some nervousness about the idea that, okay, now you're not here for us anymore.
There's probably always nervousness because all communities have challenges. But I think the residents of St. Peter Waterway agree, for the most part, that they've reached a pretty sustainable point. We're not going to pull back entirely. We're not going anywhere. LISC is not going anywhere. We're still in this community. We're still in this city. And we're certainly poised to provide assistance to them along the way. But they're at such a stable point and made so much progress over the years that our resources are better devoted to other neighborhoods to help them get to the place where St. Peter Waterway is today.
Well, Daniel Serta, you're a city planner. I wonder if you've been watching LISC's work in St. Peter Waterway and the other neighborhoods that they work with.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that I find really inspirational about the St. Peter's story in particular is you have this set of circumstances on the ground. You have demographic change that's happening, new residents that are coming in, particularly immigrants, Latino residents that are coming into that area. You have the institutional presence of CHWC, which has come an incredible distance in terms of, you know, from originally organizing itself and beginning some activities there to really pushing forward the elements of this plan. You also have a public role in terms of specific targeted public investments that have been made over the last several years with the able assistance of LISC and some other organizations. I think those are the essential ingredients in really moving a neighborhood forward. It's a combination of taking the social mix that's there, helping that neighborhood organize itself and develop the capacity, especially the grassroots leadership capacity, to sort of begin to direct its own future, and then have that combination of both external funders like LISC and the local government help on the resource side with pulling those pieces together.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm not sure if you heard at the beginning of the story, we heard from Patty Orth, who obviously is immersed in the Catholic community there, that's been there for a long time. Yeah. And one of the things she said is she was surprised that other people cared. She thought only people in her community cared about the neighborhood. And I wonder if that's something that happens when people start talking outside of their boundaries.
It absolutely does. I mean, there are sometimes social disconnects within neighborhoods, particularly when neighborhoods are going through demographic transitions. And a lot of the core in Kansas City, Kansas, this is true in parts of Kansas City and Missouri as well, you have really profound cultural differences, sometimes obstacles of issues like language and just the newness of some people that you have to overcome. But you often have that established core. There has been, you know, an unevenness, to be frank about it, over the last several decades in the level of direct governmental activity, local government attention to a lot of these neighborhoods, and that creates that sense of isolation. I worked with a number of urban core neighborhoods in Kansas City, Kansas, 20 years ago when I was in graduate school, and there was just this incredible, palpable sense of frustration that people felt like they were sort of in the trenches by themselves. That set of circumstances is changing. There's new life coming in. There's a more directive role. There's more supportive, both technical and financial resource assistance there to help pull together the pieces.
We are live right now and taking your calls. We want to know, how do you know when a community is sustainable? What's going on in your community? What does it look like? Can you tell whether it's sustainable or whether it needs that extra push? Join our conversation and call 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Now, I do wonder, Daniel Serta, you've been working in Wyandotte County for a long time, and now you're vice chair of the Planning
Commission. Actually, I just concluded my term as vice chair of the Planning Commission.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, so, that just happened this month.
But clearly, you know what's going on in a lot of the neighborhoods there, and I wonder how does what's happening in St. Peter Waterway, you know, how does it compare to some of the development in other neighborhoods? Are there lessons there? Are there others that are doing similar things?
There are others that are doing similar things. But again, like I said, I don't want to create the sense that there's a simple cookie cutter formula you have to follow. But I had somebody ask me recently, well, you know, when it does work, what are some of those essential ingredients? And I think it really does come down to that combination of those three things I mentioned. Again, government having kind of a very strong sense of purpose and the willingness to invest very strategically, play a catalytic role in helping development happen. Second part has to do, and this is absolutely, neighborhoods can't get to be sustainable if there is not some concerted focus on building the internal capacity of a neighborhood to move itself forward, as Micah said. And the third part is there has to be the life. There has to be the energy there. And one of the things that an organization like LISC can be very influential in is helping bring together people into that kind of organizing conversation. That's one of the things I think is really admirable about the Neighborhoods Now effort, is that it's helped really crystallize conversations around specific neighborhoods about what the needs are, what the opportunities are, how to move those forward. There are neighborhoods throughout Kansas City, Kansas, that might have one or another of those ingredients, but they haven't quite pulled together the others yet. There are some that are, in some respects, maybe a little bit top-heavy. There's a lot of direct, kind of straight-down governmental assistance into that area, but not that same level of grassroots support. And it hasn't quite gelled in the same way to make it truly sustainable in the way that Mike is describing.
Micah, how do you know about when there's that energy there? What does that look like?
Well, it's, again, one of those things that's easier to see than it is to describe, and easier to see than it is to measure or quantify. But I think if you go to example for Waterway Park a few years ago, as the segment before described, there was no one in Waterway Park other than people who you did not want to be there because they were engaged in activities that probably would not be considered sustainable. Today, if you go to Waterway Park, there are at least 100 people in the park every single day who are participating in activities, who are just living life. And that's what it means to see that energy and vibrance. You have to see it. We can't measure it, but we can see it when it happens, and you feel it when you go there.
I want to point out St. Peter Waterway was one of six communities that were part of the Neighborhoods Now project, which continues. The others in KCK are Downtown and Douglas Sumner, and in KCMO, Blue Hills, Ivanhoe, and Skarrett Renaissance. How were those neighborhoods picked? Did they have something to do with those criteria that Daniel's talking about?
Yeah, Daniel's criteria were definitely things that we considered. So we looked at areas that had some level of capacity already, where there was already something going on, where residents themselves were already doing something, were clamoring for change, had organized themselves to some extent, and where there was an institutional partner that we as LISC could work with. Another organization like CHWC needed to be in the area doing something. We looked at where government and the private sector was already putting some investment in, because we realized that none of us can do it by ourselves. The only way community development is successful and sustainable is if there are lots of parties who are coming in together, working together to get something done. And we looked at areas where there was need, obviously. We're not going to go into an area that is already sustainable and try and make it sustainable. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
You're listening to KC Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're speaking with Micah Kubik, who is Senior Program Officer of Greater Kansas City LISC, and Daniel Serta, who's a city planner. We're talking about targeting certain neighborhoods for urban development. I wonder, how are those other neighborhoods doing?
So for the most part, they're doing pretty well. They've all made a great deal of progress since we began Neighborhoods Now in 2006. And some of them have some wonderful projects that are coming up that I think are really going to be catalytic and transformational. So, for example, in the Ivanhoe neighborhood, not too far from where we are today, they have the Horace Mann 39th Street project, which tore down a decrepit old school building and is going to repurpose that, transform that entire parcel into senior affordable housing and duplexes for families, at the same time that they've got a new grocery store going in at 39th and Prospect there in Ivanhoe. Those two things combined really have the potential to be game changers for that neighborhood. Or in Blue Hills, you have the new 5008 Prospect Business Center, which opened just last week, which is helping to bring new jobs to neighborhood contractors in Blue Hills.
Do you see signs of change in your neighborhood? Kansas City, join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KC Currents. Now, this idea of targeting certain neighborhoods and putting a lot of resources there seems to be getting a lot of traction. You see that in the Green Impact Zone in Central, KCMO, and then the Urban Neighborhood Initiative, which overlaps both the Green Impact Zone and I believe some of the LISC neighborhoods. The Urban Neighborhood Initiative is along Troost. Daniel, what's the idea of targeting resources like this? Why not spread it out to reach as many neighborhoods as possible?
Sure, there is some debate about that. The logic of that is that, you know, governmental public resources in particular tend to be very scant. And we're in a period now, we have to understand, you know, compared to, say, 40 years ago, where the federal government was making very substantial, very direct investments in assistance to cities, that's largely gone. I mean, we're at a level of much reduced funding. So the idea is, in a time of limited public resources, doesn't it make more sense to target those very strategically and work incrementally on focused areas? And you can achieve a certain measure of success doing that. Now, the question becomes, well, how do you eventually get back to those other areas as well? Because, you know, on the long term, you really can't do that to the exclusion of certain parts of a city.
And not every neighborhood meets those criteria.
No. And to be frank, you know, if you look at something like the demographic factors I was talking about, you know, there are some areas that have lost so much population that it really raises substantial questions about the merits of making very targeted investments there.
We have a call here from Kelly in Midtown. Hi, Kelly.
Hello. My comment was about my Midtown neighborhood close to downtown, as much of the residential density in Kansas City rings the downtown area. And since the emphasis on with the city government, I feel, is to promote businesses, especially entertainment venues, neighborhood life has been greatly sacrificed to accommodate a lot of ill effects from entertainment venues, late night bars, an illegal drug trade that is boosting business at a lot of bars, and our city government has acted to obstruct neighborhoods from traffic calming and effective drug enforcement, and it's been very, very much to the detriment of the quality of life here.
And you were wondering about neighborhood associations, too, the role that they play?
Mine is, I feel, extremely weak. There are a lot of impediments to joining the neighborhood association, such as a requirement that you pay a membership fee and pay it 3 months before voting on elected officials. We've had people in the association that have been here 20 years and do apparently nothing. And I think term limits and a wider allowance of people in the neighborhood participating in their association, and also a stronger voice in city government. And I know the new city charter greatly weakened neighborhood associations' ability to implement changes in their community. And,
well,
and that
Kelly, we want to
too.
See what our guests have to say about some of the things we pointed out. Particularly, Micah, Kelly points out that she feels that Kansas City, Missouri has really emphasized business development. And you may drive through a city, a neighborhood, and see a lot of businesses, and it looks very vibrant. Is there a kind of trade-off there?
Well, I don't think there should be, and I don't think there has to be. I think, for the most part, strong neighborhoods are ones that also have jobs nearby for residents to go to and to bring income back into the neighborhood. Unfortunately, many neighborhoods, particularly in Kansas City's urban core, the employers left 50 years ago and have not been replaced since, and that's been to the detriment of the neighborhood. So I think we absolutely need to be bringing businesses back into the urban core, but there certainly is a balance that has to be struck between being too accommodating to businesses, especially those that are going to compromise the quality of life. There are some businesses that no neighborhood wants in them for good reasons, and we should all work to do that. But I also want to touch on her point about neighborhood associations being absolutely essential, and this goes to Daniel's point from earlier, too. Unless you have internal capacity in the neighborhood, unless you have a strong resident voice there, you're never going to get anything accomplished. The residents are the ones who have to go to City Hall and demand change. The squeaky wheel always gets the grease there. And the residents are the ones who ultimately are going to be charged with the success of the neighborhood.
What do you notice about the needs of your neighborhood or the assets? Call in 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to join the conversation. Now, I do wonder, how do you build those neighborhood organizations if they're not really there or vibrant?
Well, if they're not there, that's a really core dilemma, because Micah alluded to this earlier. You can't have an entity like this just sort of sweep in and offer to do. I mean, you really have to have some willingness. That is one of the things that I think LISC is nationally very effective at, is where there is some level of energy, providing assistance, providing training, providing leadership development opportunities to help a neighborhood get itself organized. I absolutely would underscore what Micah just said. If the city's priorities seem misplaced to people in a community, it is absolutely incumbent upon them to take the steps, and they may need external assistance to get this organized, but to organize themselves and make it very clear that, you know, there's a mismatch there between what the city is doing and what the neighborhood's needs truly are.
Do you see a difference between how Kansas City, Missouri and Kansas City, Kansas, and perhaps some of the other municipalities approach urban development like this in neighborhoods?
Oh, there absolutely are. I mean, there are cities like New York City that have these community councils where effectively these broad scale neighborhood associations are actually part of the functioning of city government. They're actually elected resident leaders that have effectively veto power over major developments within their neighborhoods. There have been ideas kicked around about that for the last 30, 40 years about how to most effectively do that. I would just say that the composition is different in those two sides of the state line. I've worked in Kansas City, Missouri as well, and structurally the issues in terms of how the City Hall approaches neighborhood associations works somewhat differently in each of those places.
Scott in Kansas City, Kansas, you were going to talk about the unified government. What's particular about that? Have you had experience with working with the unified government?
Yes, I have. Unified government has a history of being kind of difficult, a little slow to change. And I was wondering what your guest reactions were to working here versus working maybe in KC Moe or Overland Park or basically anywhere else in the metro.
Well, Micah, your organization works with both, and I realize it might be kind of sensitive because you need to work well with these organizations, but do you notice a difference in the structure of how they work in neighborhoods?
I think the structure is a little bit different, but I think that's mostly a factor of size. Obviously, Kansas City, Missouri is a little bit larger than Kansas City, Kansas. And of course, the way City Hall itself is structured on both sides of the state line is a little different. In KCK, the mayor has, frankly, a lot more formal structural power than the mayor in Kansas City, Missouri
interesting.
Does.
We were just talking about that.
But I would also say that I think it is absolutely true that every single neighborhood resident I've ever talked to, regardless of whether they lived in Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, Minneapolis, regardless where they are in the country, always thinks that City Hall moves slow and that progress is slow to come. So I think we always have to be mindful of the fact that government is a necessarily slow and bureaucratic structure, and it's going to take us a lot longer than we want it to get things done.
When a community has become revitalized or sustainable, housing costs can go up, and then you can get into questions about gentrification. When are there dangers of making a neighborhood so revitalized that you begin to price people out of that neighborhood? Micah?
Absolutely, that's a danger. I think there's a lot of research out there that shows that oftentimes the fear about gentrification is more pronounced than the reality of it, but it's something that we have to be mindful of. And I think the best way to do that is, again, to always make sure that residents are themselves in charge. If residents are the ones setting the priorities, setting the actions, and frankly, figuring out who's going to do the work, I'd say one of the things that we have learned in our work is that the controversy is often not about the what to do, but rather the who is to do it. And if you have the right institutional partners coming in and doing the work, you can make sure that it happens in a way that helps to avoid some of those concerns about gentrification and interlopers. And you can also take steps through the public sector and elsewhere. You can use tools to make sure that the neighborhood remains open to everyone, because I think we all have discovered that mixed income neighborhoods are really the ones that are most sustainable over the long term and the most vibrant.
Daniel, any thoughts?
Well, I would say I absolutely agree with everything Micah just said. Kansas City, Kansas, we have a mismatch often between employers and the capabilities of residents. And that, to me, raises the question of government being very clear in what its objectives are in supporting development. You know, our recent discussion, for example, in Kansas City, Kansas, around urban redevelopment has focused on this idea that development really needs to be geared to meeting the needs and help building the capacity and level of opportunity for people that are within the community, so that as neighborhoods redevelop, it is the current residents of those neighborhoods that are able to share in the benefits of that redevelopment. It's not simply just a matter of drawing in outside companies and kind of plopping them down and saying, look, we've improved this neighborhood. It's a matter of more organically working with residents to help share the benefits of the development as it happens.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us. Daniel Cerda, City Planner and Vice Chair of the Wyandotte County Planning Commission. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Micah Kubik of Greater Kansas City LISC. It was great talking to you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we visit a gym that's training cheerleaders who are rooting for themselves. They are the athletes. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. A new report from the Catholic Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph shows an increase in reports of child sexual abuse and suspicious behavior toward children. The report is the work of the Diocese Office of Child and Youth Protection, which we profiled last month on KC Currents. Alex Smith is following up on that story. He reports that while the overall numbers of reports are up, confirmed cases of abuse appear to be down.
The diocese received 107 reports of abuse or suspicious behavior in the period from July of 2012 through June of this year. That's an increase of 35% from the previous period, although that increase is only in referrals. Those are cases that fall outside of the jurisdiction of the diocese. Jennifer Valenti is ombudsman for the diocese. She says an increase in reports isn't a bad thing.
The fact that I'm getting so many referral calls tells me that people are taking their personal responsibility very seriously. that after receiving our mandated reporter training, they fully understand their responsibility and they're ready to take action based on their responsibility.
Within the diocese, reports are slightly down. There were 17 reports of sexual abuse and 16 reports of suspicious behavior, or what the diocese calls boundary violations. Valenti says the report doesn't specify whether the actions reported took place recently or in previous years.
Boundary violations, typically, they're talking about recent behaviors. Sexual abuse reports are both historical and recent.
After investigations of these reports, four people were removed from service. Two cases of sexual abuse were substantiated. Both of the individuals named had already been removed from service. Four of the cases reported have investigations pending. Valenti says whether the cases end up in court remains to be seen.
The diocese reports every single case to civil authorities, so it just depends on if civil authorities, if the prosecuting attorney's office chooses to file charges, and that's something obviously beyond our control.
The reports from the diocese have been criticized by the Survivors Network for those abused by priests. SNAP says the diocese should name the accused and alert the public each time a report is received. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
According to the National Cheerleading Association, more than 3 million Americans participate in the sport. But cheerleading is no longer just about pom-poms and whipping crowd spirit into a frenzy. It has evolved into a bona fide sport where many athletes, as they're now considered, train year-round. These athletes work on the strength, balance, and gymnastic skills they need to stand out and win competitions. Casey Current's Susan Wilson recently visited a gym in Grandview where teaching girl power and the sport of cheerleading go hand in hand.
You could easily ride right past it, a nondescript, low-slung building with white garage doors on Grandview Road. But inside is the home of Nash Gym All-Star Elite Cheerleading. All-star refers to a cheerleading group that is not attached to a sports team. In fact, there's no need to have an actual team to cheer for, since the focus is on athletics and stunts. Tonight, there's a buzz of activity right before class begins. Older girls are practicing in clusters along the blue foam-covered floor, and smaller girls are using thick red mats to tumble and floor posts to balance. Nash Gym co-owner Jamisha Miller is working with a group of girls on their routines. Today's lesson? Perfecting what's called a TikTok, a complicated stunt where the flyer, the girl who's lifted to the top, switches legs as she's hoisted in the air. Coach Miller focuses on building teamwork and the flyer's courage so that this stunt comes off injury-free and technically correct.
Are you okay? It looked like you were afraid. Let's go again. This you can't be afraid to do.
8-year-old Ramaya looks nervous as her teammates prepare to hoist her in the air. But as Coach Miller counts and encourages, each girl performs her role. The result? Ramaya is beaming proudly at the top of the formation, one leg stretched high in the air. So why start a cheerleading gym? Jamisha Miller caught the cheerleading bug as a junior at Northeast High School. She saw that girls could have fun while building character and confidence. So in 2000, Jamisha and her sister CJ Nash started Nash Gym Elite All-Stars, using cheerleading as a way to empower and encourage girls in the community. The program's name, Nash Gym, is derived from CJ's last name and Jamisha's initials. The sisters saw the cheerleading program as a part of a spiritual mission, a gift from God, they say. They started coaching about 20 students in tumbling, stunts, and cheer.
It was free at first. We were operating wherever we could. If there was a school that would let us use their gym, out of the Boys and Girls Club here and there, just wherever we could. And then eventually we realized we're going to have to charge something.
With those fees, they hired professional coaches and found a permanent home. Their members have grown to include 150 athletes, ages 3 to 18 years old. Nash Gym serves everyone, but Jamisha Miller says that being a mostly African-American gym makes the program unique.
There are other states where there are, you know, predominantly African-American gyms, but here in the Midwest, we are the only one. And really, because when a girl looks out there and she sees someone that looks like her, it inspires her even more. Sometimes we don't realize it because we are in a culture where we have, yes, accepted that we are multicultural, but there is a certain part of you inside when you see people like you doing a certain elite thing. You automatically think that can be me.
Parent Vernell Woods says that her daughter, Sydney, has benefited from cheerleading, and it's helped her daughter's self-confidence both physically and socially.
If a friend don't like me, I can move on from that, or I'm not as scared to, you know, do cartwheels or backbends. You know, just motivate her.
7-year-old Sydney Woods says that Nash Gym has helped improve her skills.
I learned how to be a better cheerleader and how to foot better.
Jamisha Miller's passion is building the self-esteem and confidence of African-American girls using the discipline of cheerleading. That's how she hopes to fight the many forces in society that attack the self-worth of young African-American women and girls.
I found that, especially in the younger age, a lot of girls are envious. A lot of girls haven't quite learned how to communicate with other girls in a nice way, or maybe because they are dealing with some self-esteem issues, maybe there's something going on in their home. All those things that you have to learn, they learn that here. And it allows them to look at themselves in the way that maybe they haven't before. And we remind them of how beautiful they are, how gorgeous they are. And you would be surprised of how many girls, as beautiful as they may be, they don't quite believe it.
Getting the girls ready for competition takes hard work and perseverance. Nash Gym Elite has 8 competitive teams and 2 non-competitive teams. Coach Miller says they faced particular challenges early on because they were a mostly African-American team.
It was more of didn't like our style. We didn't look like the teams that, you know, they were used to judging, or they couldn't believe that our girls were the age that they were because they were doing so many elite things that then they would try to challenge our girls on their age, which they've always been appropriately in their age bracket. There's just some people who look at you and look at your brown skin and think you're inferior. And then I think in some cases, because the expectation was so low, when we did come out and blow them away, it worked sometimes in our advantage.
Just like Nash Gym cheerleaders, cheerleading itself has fought long and hard to be respected as a legitimate sport. Some critics still view cheerleading as a fluff activity involving more spirit than athletic substance. Aren't girls better off going into a more traditional sport like basketball or volleyball? Jamisha Miller thinks cheerleading built a strong work ethic and teamwork.
Through their regime, they've learned that you put on a good face. You may not be feeling it in the inside, but when you go to work, you work and you work hard, and you're working as a team.
Coach Miller and her team is preparing her girls to be competition ready by November, when the first round of regional cheerleading challenges begin. And this past weekend, Nash Gym Elite All-Stars moved to its new home in Lee's Summit, where they hope to take their work to the next level. For Casey Currents, I'm Susan Wilson.
5, 6, 7, 8.
See images from the Nash Gym Elite All-Star Cheerleading Gym, which is now in Lee's Summit, on our website, kcur.org. That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast will be every Thursday morning from now on. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter @kcurrents.